Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to Ask Anything Wednesday on the Albert Mohler Program. Here at the center of the week, you get to set the agenda. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. We'll talk about just about anything. The issue could be political. It could be cultural, theological, doctrinal. It could be a family issue. We're going to be talking about issues in the news today and issues that are really evolving and revolving around your world. The phone number, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. First, to review some issues in the news. Of course, all eyes today were on the United States Senate, which rejected a proposed constitutional amendment to ban same-sex marriage. That's the lead, by the way, for the New York Times. And that tells you a whole lot right there. You talk about editorializing in the news. There you have it in the lead. What was or is the Marriage Protection Amendment? It is an amendment to define what marriage is. It is to define marriage as the union of a man and a woman. It is not even to mention same-sex marriage, because it's not just same-sex marriage that would be banned. It would be any other thing called as marriage other than the union of a man and a woman. And yet you can see how the media is beginning to twist this. The vote was only 49-48. That is, the senators voting for the amendment basically numbered just one more than last time, 2 years ago. The gain of one vote. This, ladies and gentlemen, is an embarrassment. It is an embarrassment to this nation. It is an embarrassment to the Senate. And it is an embarrassment to the Republican leadership in the United States Senate. Because they could not even deliver all of their own party conference on this issue. As a matter of fact, Judd Gregg and Arlen Specter fell off the reservation on this one and joined the other side. This is a big issue. Mark DeWine of Ohio voted for it, became a co-sponsor of the amendment. But this is a net negative over time. So what are we going to do about it? Number one, we're going to realize we didn't expect it to pass. This tells us again what we're up against. And what we were up against is not only the obstructionism of some who are just baldly lying about this proposal and the need for it. Those who say, let's just leave it to the states or the Constitution is supposed to expand liberty, not to restrict liberty. You know, even when you get rid of all those nonsensical issues, we are up against an enormous political lethargy. And we are up against also a group of people who are elected to political office who seem to be far more concerned about not losing their positions than doing the right thing. They are scared to death about all the media opposition and the cultural opposition to the Marriage Protection Amendment. And it is obvious that they are unwilling, even in a situation like this, to stand up and do the right thing. And the right thing is to define marriage. Last night, I was listening to the press coverage, and I was also listening to some of the cable news coverage and all the rest. And it's very interesting, again, how they contextualize this. A lot of the talking heads out there are simply saying, look, this is the inevitable next step in the expansion of liberty. And, of course, they always go back and say, you begin with slavery and you begin with women unable to vote and slavery was abolished and women were given the franchise and the civil rights movement of the 1960s. And you just go on and on. And this is the next thing. Well, here's the problem. And by the way, that always comes also with the argument that liberty is always right. And that restricting liberty is always wrong. Just think about this. You cannot have a civilization without restricting liberty. The question is, which liberties do you restrict and which liberties do you authorize? And to suggest that the founders of this country or the current citizens of this country intend to legalize same-sex marriage and to allow that to happen is just nonsense. That's why, for instance, even in Alabama yesterday, voters overwhelmingly approved a measure to define marriage as the union of a man and a woman. In every single state where this has come before the people have answered decisively. You would think that would have an impact in the United States Senate. You would think that would even have an impact upon persons who are afraid of losing their positions in the next election. But they fear the media elite, the cultural elite, more than they fear the voters on this. And if the voters let them get by with it, then that tells you just how lethargic the voters are as well. You know, we're talking about that as a political issue today because life often intersects politics. There's just no way around it. This is a big issue. Who decides what the law is? That's a political question. The law is a reality in our everyday lives. And so there are people out there who say, I really don't want to deal with the political issues. Well, you can stop. You can fall short. You can resist dealing with the political issues only so far and only for so long. Because you cannot avoid dealing in the public square, you cannot avoid dealing with the law, and you cannot avoid the fact that we all bear a responsibility in this country for the formation of public policy. While we're talking about this issue, let me just visit a couple of editorials. The Wall Street Journal today, entitled Justice Kennedy's Culture War, it starts out very, very promisingly. It says the Supreme Court is busy this week, but Justice Anthony Kennedy should take a moment to tune into the Senate debate on gay marriage. As the man who enabled this latest front in the culture wars, it is the least he can do. That's the most efficient way to think about the Senate debate this week on the Marriage Protection Amendment, which would create a national definition of marriage as a union of a man and a woman. We remain opposed to federal interference on this issue, believing that issues of family life and law are best settled in state legislatures. Yet given the way activist courts have turned gay marriage into a national issue, it's no surprise that Congress joined in the fray. That is a promising beginning. Except for the part where they say, we remain opposed to federal interference in this issue. They began the editorial by acknowledging federal interference. And then they say, we're opposed to federal interference. This is one of the most self-contradictory essays I have ever seen. And whether it reflects a difference of opinion among the editors of the Wall Street Journal or some kind of schizophrenia among one editor who wrote this, I can't say. But I can say this. They begin by correctly identifying the problem, and that is that there are federal courts poised to legalize same-sex marriage. And you cannot make that acknowledgement and then say, but we want to leave it a state issue. You know, just look at abortion again. 1973, Roe v. Wade. There went the argument out the window in 24 hours. And we all know that's about what is going to happen on this issue as well. The Boston Globe is also out with an editorial. This is what it says. Gay marriage isn't a real threat. In Massachusetts, married gay couples are not masterminding terrorist bombings. They're not refining weapons-grade uranium, nor are they running up the federal budget deficits. Married gay couples are not monitoring their fellow Americans' phone calls and emails. They haven't cut Medicaid, and they didn't put that donut hole in the middle of Medicare's new prescription drug program, end quote. That is what you call ridiculous manipulation with words. That says nothing. You know, as if the case against gay marriage is that they are otherwise going to be enriching weapons-grade uranium. You know, we will take seriously the Boston Globe when the Boston Globe begins to take seriously the issues and resist this kind of propagandistic, this is really what one old preacher used to call an effulgence of complication, which means it's just a lot of words thrown out there to impress and to scare people. But it is not a responsible editorial position. Speaking of issues in the news, this is the 25th anniversary of the AIDS crisis. And when you're talking about AIDS or acquired immunity defense deficit syndrome, you know, it is interesting, isn't it, that AIDS, AIDS, has now entered the lexicon as the name of the disease. We don't even use the words that AIDS stands for much anymore. But this acquired immune deficit syndrome or deficiency is now a disease that has taken millions of victims. In the United States alone, you're looking at a large number of persons who have been infected with this disease. More than 25 million persons worldwide have died. 70 million have been infected with AIDS. George Will offers a very interesting insight in his essay published in various newspapers in his column this week. He points out, and I read, the 14th century Black Death killed one-third of Europe's population, but it was in the air, food, and water, so breathing, eating, and drinking were risky behaviors. AIDS is much more difficult to acquire. Like other large components of America's healthcare costs, AIDS is mostly the result of behavior that is now widely known to be risky. Now, George Will is taking on one of the most politically incorrect arguments that we now face. He is arguing eloquently, honestly, and correctly that the only way to deal with the AIDS crisis is to deal with behavior. Now, this just shows us morally that we are in a situation as a culture in which we are hoping for a pill or a shot to solve behavioral problems. We are looking for a cure or a vaccine for this disease so that behavior doesn't have to change. Now, let me be absolutely clear. Compassion for those who have this disease, requires that we do hope that a cure is found, that we do hope that a vaccine is found. But honesty compels us to say that what we are looking at with AIDS was in the beginning and is now a behavioral issue. Those who do not have sex outside of marriage and then have sex only in marriage are not going to get AIDS. That is just a matter of fact. There may be some marginal cases and blood transfusions or all the rest, but that would not represent a public health crisis, now would it? We'll be back for Ask Anything Wednesday. The phone number 877-893-8255. Coast to coast, this is the Albert Mueller Program. It's Ask Anything Wednesday on the Albert Mueller Program. This is your opportunity to call and set the agenda. We'll talk about the topic that's on your mind or the question that you have wanted to ask. The phone number, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. We will also get to some questions sent by mail in just a moment. First, we're going to go to Richard, listening on the World Wide Web, calling from Tellico Plains, Tennessee. Go ahead, Richard.
Yes, Dr. Mueller. My question is... I've got some pastor friends that are very intelligent and hold a sovereign grace position, but yet they spiritualize away the earthly millennial reign of Christ. You know, it's kind of what's up with that, you know, why they are so on when it comes to soteriology, but yet they are off when it comes to eschatology.
Well, I'll just have to identify myself right up front, Richard, as a premillennialist. I do believe that there will be an historic millennium in the fulfillment of Revelation 20, verses 4 and 7, where there's an explicit reference to those, the saints who reign with Christ for 1,000 years. And then in verse 7 it says, when the 1,000 years are completed, Satan will be released from his prison. You know, you ask a very interesting question, and here a bit of honesty will really help us. And Richard asked it this question in a very interesting way, and I think actually a helpful way. You know, in other words, what motivates this position? Well, everyone who takes the Bible seriously and the Bible as authority is going to have to say, I am motivated by the biblical text. And Richard accuses those who hold to an amillennial position of spiritualizing the text. And the amillennial position, a, is the alpha privative in the Greek. That means, if it comes before a word, it means not that. So a Gnostic is one who knows. So an agnostic is one who doesn't know. A theist is one who believes in God. So an atheist is one who doesn't believe in God. And so when you say amillennial, you're saying one who doesn't believe in the millennium. What the amillennialists believe, and by the way, this is a very rich tradition in interpretation in the church. It included folks, well, most folks like the Reformers and others going forward. I guess a part of it is, Richard, that you would have to say that the amillennial position emerged at least partly out of the delay of Christ's return, of the fact that the church age is obviously a very long age. And it has been now in 2,000 years since the time of Christ. And there are also some numbers in Scripture that we do not hold to be literal, such as, just to give you an example, when Jesus rebukes Peter about forgiveness and tells him that we are to forgive 70 times 7 times, none of us believes that means 490. In other words, that was a number meant for exaggeration in order to say there's no limit to the number of times you must forgive. And especially the use of a timeline like 1,000 years in the Bible, and I'm just trying to make the best case I can, Richard, for a position I don't hold. They would say that that's best understood as the spiritual affirmation of the fact that Christ and the saints do reign. Now, I'm with you, Richard, in saying that I can't accept that. I can't accept it on two grounds. Number one, the exegetical ground, that is the interpretation of the biblical text. I think it is just most responsible to believe that an historic claim is being made here unless there is really good evidence to believe otherwise. I don't see that evidence. The second thing is, I think the thousand-year reign is a part of biblical eschatology that is absolutely important. It is a component that reminds us that Christ's preeminence in this created order is going to be demonstrated through this long period in which Christ and the saints are going to reign. And I think unless there's some historical realization of that, then we're missing something very, very important. I hope that helps you, Richard. You know, that's a big question, what motivates the amillennial position. If there's an amillennialist out there who would like to call and tell us what motivates him, the number is 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. And before we leave it, let me just say there are three major positions: postmillennial, amillennial, and premillennial. The majority of people today are probably premillennialists. That's the position I hold. Among evangelicals, I think that's probably safe. There are also a good number of amillennials. The postmillennials believe that Christ is going to come at the end of this period of time, which will be a time of human progress. And that is a position that is more difficult to find today for a lot of good reasons. Let's go to Russell calling from Camden, Arkansas, listening on XM 170. Go ahead, Russell.
Yes, Dr. Moeller. I had a question about the trichotomy of man. I'd always been taught that man was made up of a flesh or a body, a soul, and also a spirit. And I was reading in Wayne Grudem's Systematic Theology, and he holds a dichotomy view where the soul and the spirit were kind of the same thing. And, you know, with all the inspirational speakers and things out there talking about getting in touch with your spirit or your soul, I was just wondering what kind of biblical view could we take of that?
I believe in a multi-plastic plural formity dichotomy position. I just made it up. In other words, I don't think there's a definitive biblical answer to that, Russell. It's a good question. I do think we know one thing for absolute certain. The Bible is very clear that we are at least made up of two component parts, two component dimensions. So at the very least, a biblical Christian has to be a dichotomist. In other words, that there are two, body and soul. Now, the question is whether the soul and the spirit are the same. And I tend to believe that they are. And the more popular way that you see among many evangelicals of talking about a trichotomous position of body, soul, and spirit, I think is on fairly weak grounds trying to define the difference between the soul and the spirit. Because I just have a hard time doing that. And especially when you're given the Old Testament language, the nephesh, or nephesh, depending on how you want to pronounce the Hebrew, it is clearly both the soul and the spirit. At least in terms of the Old Testament presentation. So I think you're coming up with some fairly artificial distinctions between the soul and the spirit. This is not an issue on which biblical orthodoxy rests, that is, between dichotomy and trichotomy. Whether it's body and soul, the soul being also the spirit, or body, soul, and spirit as three component parts, that's not a big issue. I'll tell you where orthodoxy is. It has to focus with a very clear theological concern. Number one, if we argue that we are not at least both body and soul, that we are not spiritual beings who are also enfleshed, we have to recognize there are those two component parts, because in the Christian life, this is very, very important. A part of what it means to be made in the image of God is that we are spiritual beings in a way that other created beings are not. And this also has to do with our eternality. It has to do with the fact, by the way, that in the age to come, we will still be at least a dichotomy. We will still be both body and soul, because remember, in heaven, we are going to have resurrection bodies. And the same for those who are in hell. They will be enfleshed, embodied persons. And so orthodoxy requires that. And the other place that that really comes important is in the question of death. You know, what happens to you when you die? The Bible's very clear that those who die in Christ are absent from the body and present with the Lord. So in other words, their body, the body we put in the ground is clearly physical, corporeal, material, and it is going to pass away. But we also speak of the person properly as currently, even now, being with the Lord. And thus we look forward to the reuniting of resurrection body and spirit in heaven. So I hope that answers your question, Russell. You know, I would have to say again that I would resist any dogmatic claim that we know for sure whether we should hold to a dichotomist or a trichotomist position. We know we can't believe in anything less than dichotomy, but I think that the burden is on the trichotomist right now. And I'll tell you, the reason why I think a lot of this entered our evangelical language is because of a couple of things, even like tracts. There were a couple of influential tracts that were put together during the 1960s and 70s, one of them, I believe, by Campus Crusade for Christ, that really helped to make this very popular, and it just kind of entered the evangelical parlance. Someone else who I think had a lot to do with popularizing this was Bill Gothard through his conferences and seminars. But this much we know. Human beings are body and soul. We are spiritual beings. And we'll be right back.
listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello and welcome back to Ask Anything Wednesday. Good questions today, really centering on Bible and theology. And, of course, that's fair game. And as a theologian, nothing encourages me more than to hear people thinking theologically and asking good theological and biblical questions. If you have questions along these lines or questions about anything in terms of today's news, current events, Christian worldview questions, the phone number is 877-893-8255 or 877-893-TALK. Let's go to Josh calling from Pensacola, Florida, listening on XM170. Go ahead, Josh.
Yeah, Dr. Mohler, in perspective of the family in 1 Corinthians 5, when you have a father who claims Christ his whole life and has shown fruit and yet leaves his wife for unbiblical reasons, just because he wants to leave and divorces her, and yet he still claims Christ, what is the position as a son? How should you handle that? Should you treat him as a believer and not dine with him, or should you treat him and in the respect of he's my father and I should continue to pursue that relationship?
Josh, that is a very difficult question. And yet, even as I hear you ask that question, I'm thinking there must be many people who would be in a similar situation. Let's just go look at the biblical text for a moment. It's found in 1 Corinthians chapter 5. Paul says this. I'm going to begin to read at verse 9. I wrote to you in my letter not to associate with immoral people. I did not at all mean with the immoral people of this world or with the covetous and swindlers or with idolaters, for then you would have to go out of the world. But actually, I wrote you not to associate with any so-called brother if he is an immoral person or covetous or an idolater or a reviler or a drunkard or a swindler, not even to eat with such a one. For what have I to do with judging outsiders? Do you not judge those who are within the church? Okay, you know, I have a couple of thoughts to share with you here, Josh, and I'm going to be honest and say that I'm just trying to think this through with you as we move along. Number one, the immediate context of 1 Corinthians chapter 5 is a local church. It is the church at Corinth. And in the background to this is controversy within that church over the fellowship meal. So at the very least, this means that the church should exercise its discipline so that a believer who is acting like an unbeliever is outside the discipline of the church and is rejecting and resisting correction. That person should not be allowed into the fellowship meal. That person should not be allowed at the fellowship table, the table of the Lord, as if he is a believer in good standing. I think that is the baseline, most important meaning of that text. Now, Paul's distinction here in 1 Corinthians chapter 5 between persons who are in such sin out in the world and those who claim to be brothers, that's exactly the language he uses here, a so-called brother. It reminds us that we expect sinners to act like sinners, and we should expect Christian believers to act like believers. I think in the context of the local church, Paul's point is clear. This person is to be forbidden access to the table, is not to be received into the fellowship of the church as if he were acting and living like a believer, but is to be treated like an unbeliever. Josh, I can feel even the urgency in your question, in your voice here. When it comes to a son with his father, I'm not sure it's exactly the same context, but it is excruciatingly the same question. How does one confront a brother with his sin? And I'm going to say this as both a son and a father, Josh. I think it is very difficult for a son to confront his father with his sin. If you find yourself in this situation, I'm going to pray that the Lord will give you all the courage and humility and conviction you will need even to confront your own father with this sin. Now, as to whether or not you ever eat in his house or anything like that, I'm not sure that 1 Corinthians 5 answers that question for you. But I would say that you cannot, on biblical grounds, do anything that would insinuate that you condone his behavior here in leaving his wife without cause. And I realize this is very difficult. Nothing in this life is more difficult in so many ways than dealing with this kind of question within a family. Josh, does that help at all?
Yeah, and basically that's, you know, the otherwise counsel that I've sought on this issue is that, Well, we're just not sure.
Yeah, well, I do think that the Bible is very clear that he who is unwilling to leave father and mother and brother and sister for the sake of the kingdom is not worthy of the kingdom. I don't think that's what you're called to here. In other words, your own profession of faith in Christ, your own following of Christ, is not what is in jeopardy here. So that's not what's in question. But as one Christian believer to another, even a son to a father has to confront the father on the basis of gospel truth. And I just pray the Lord will give you all that you'll need to really determine how you are to respond to this in the most Christ-like way. But I want to tell you, I admire you for being a follower and a son who so desperately wants to do the right thing. The phone number 877-893-8255. It's Ask Anything Wednesday, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. Interesting questions today. We're going next to Hardensburg, Indiana, where Jeremy's on the line, listening on XM 170. Go ahead, Jeremy.
Yes, sir. I've got a question. In the Old Testament, it talks about Moses and talks about God said that Moses asked God if he could see his face, and he said that if he did, he would die. Now, what exactly did Moses see when he talked to God face to face? Would that be more like Jesus, like the fourth person in the fiery furnace, or what?
Well, you know, that's a very interesting question. And in terms of Old Testament typology, there have been those who have pointed to that very text and said that it was Jesus in some form. But I just think reading the text as simply, directly, and literally as we can, Jeremy, I think, first of all, that the phrase face-to-face is a part of our problem here. Because if you just take the Old Testament text, look at Exodus in particular, it tells us that God cannot be seen with the human eye directly. In fact, when God did allow Moses to see him and put quotation marks around the see him, you'll remember that God hid Moses in the cleft of the rock, and then he passed by. And in fact, in the Hebrew, it says God's backside passed by. All that means is that it wasn't the direct presence of God, but it was God's glory that passed Moses by. Moses, by the way, is so affected by this that when he comes down from the mountain, he is still bearing the reflected Shekinah glory of God. Now, let's just think about phrases or terms of speech, figures of speech for a moment, because when we say we had a face-to-face meeting, that generally means we're meeting in person. That's what we mean. That doesn't mean we just locked on our faces. But, you know, for human beings, that's no big deal because we can look at each other and not die. That's good news. But I think it just very clearly here refers to the fact that Moses had this intimacy with God. By God's own invitation, God revealed himself directly to Moses such that he didn't die. Now, by the way, in Deuteronomy chapter 4, Moses recollects this kind of experience when he speaks to the children of Israel and says, what other people has ever heard God speak from the fire and survived? You know, the very fact that he was in the presence of God and survived, that's a sign of God's mercy. And you'll remember in Exodus 20, and even looking back to Exodus 19, there's a very clear indication of the special nature of this mountain. God warned Moses that not even animals were to come close during this time, lest they die. But here I think we should see face-to-face as a figure, because the other thing is that God is not a body. And therefore, when we're talking about a face, we're in danger of suggesting that God has a body and thus a face as we have. In other words, this is about God's mercy to allow Moses to be in his intimate presence. And even that, not directly. And I appreciate the question, Jeremy. Good thinking. Let's go to David calling from Louisville, Kentucky, listening on WFIA. Go right ahead, David.
Yes, my question is that you were talking earlier about the 1,000 years of peace, and then to that point, that people would be released. I'm just trying to figure out what that would be. Just from reading in Scripture, it talks about how the beast and the Antichrist will both be cast into the eternal fire. Why would that not be the immediate case for Satan as well?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question. And a part of asking a question like that, David, is we better take a step back and say, whatever is revealed in Scripture reveals the glory of God to the maximum. In other words, the fact that God perfectly decided to do it this way means it's perfect. I'm not suggesting that you're insinuating otherwise, but I mean, there's certain things that we almost don't ask in terms of why did God do this, because God doesn't tell us. When he tells us why, we know why. Otherwise, a lot of things we don't know why. But at the end of the millennium, as is recorded in Revelation chapter 20, we read that when the 1,000 years are completed, Satan will be released from prison, and he will come out to deceive the nations which are in the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them together for the war. The number of them is like the sand of the seashore. And they came up on the broad plain of the earth and surrounded the camp of the saints and the beloved city, and fire came down from heaven and devoured them. Now listen to verse 10. And the devil who deceived them was thrown into the lake of fire and brimstone, where the beast and the false prophet are also, and they will be tormented day and night forever and ever. So I think the easiest way to understand this, David, is that at the end of the reign of Jesus and the saints in the millennium, then Satan is loose to bring about the final cataclysmic battle. And at the end of that final cataclysmic battle, then he is himself thrown into the lake of fire and brimstone. So for God's pleasure and good glory, the display of his greatness and his mercy and his judgment, it appears that God sees it best that Satan should be loosed at this time such that his defeat would be witnessed by those who were reigning with Christ. And I think that's probably the key insight from that passage. Appreciate your call, David. Very quickly, let's go to Jeremy, who's calling from Clarksville, Tennessee. Go ahead, Jeremy.
Yes, Dr. Mueller. My question is, how does God experience time? I mean, I don't believe he's just in the present, but is he in the past as he is in the present and in the future as he is in the present as well?
Wow, what a question. Let me tell you, Jeremy, this was the most perplexing question for me as a young theologian. I mean, young, like 14. I can remember sitting in the pew of church wondering about God and time. You know, I started thinking as just a teenager about what was before time. Time is created. Now, let's just think about this for a moment. We cannot think in terms other than time. It is impossible. To be human is to be a temporal being that knows nothing other than time. We speak about present and past and future. We experience the ticking of the clock, the passing of the calendar. We watch our bodies age. We watch children grow up. We know that time, well, the old hymn says it this way. Oh, God, our help in ages past. It says, time like an ever-rolling stream bears all its sons away. Yeah, that's just the way it is. Time is just who we are. But time is God's creation. As a matter of fact, time did not exist until God created the universe and set the universe in motion, because time is actually a measurement of movement. Time is a measurement of the movement of the celestial creation and the celestial objects. We know that just even by the passing of the calendar and the rotation and circulation of the planets around the sun and the Earth's rotation on its axis and all the rest. God is not in time at all. So think of it this way. Think of this as a part of God's condescension to us. The only way we can understand God is in terms that we can understand. And the only kind of terms we can understand are temporal terms. But there is no time in God. None. Period. That's why, again, sometimes our hymns really remind us of what the Bible tells us. We sing that hymn that ends by speaking of when time will be no more. Time itself is a temporary creation. In heaven, there will be no calendars. There'll be no clocks. Now, Jeremy, one of the things that also affects the way we think is that we think in past, present, and future. We think of our decisions when we plan them, when we do them, when we reflect on them afterwards. God is not a temporal being. And so when we talk about God's decisions or God's decrees, we're talking about logical priority. We're not talking about a temporal order. Great question. This is one the theologians can chew on until time is no more. We'll be right back with some final thoughts. Welcome back. Interesting questions on today's edition of the Albert Mueller Program, Ask Anything Wednesday. We also receive some interesting questions by email. For instance, a question about language. A writer, Bob, writes in from New Jersey, and he said, I've noticed you frequently use the word persons when I believe the correct word is people. I do not have my grammar books handy, but I did find this on the internet. And he's quoting here that says, people is the plural of person, is by far the preferred usage. In fact, Webster's 10th New Collegiate Dictionary doesn't recognize persons with its own entry. It's mentioned only as a footnote to people. The use of persons is discouraged, end quote. He asked the question, you know, why do you use the word persons rather than people? It is because in the world of theology, it is important to very clearly emphasize personality with the person. That's why. And by the way, it comes down also this way to legal worlds now, where it's increasingly the same thing. When you're talking about people, it's fine to say people or a person or whatever. But the reason why you make it persons in a theological context is to make clear that you are asserting the personality, the fact that this is a person who is making decisions, experiencing things, and is not just an automaton. And in this world, that's becoming increasingly important. For instance, on questions like euthanasia, questions of personhood, and all the rest, it is virtually impossible now to avoid using the plural persons. And I think here you see an evolution of the language as well. A question, how does a woman prepare for marriage? Charlie writing, he said, I understand that you advocate women plan for marriage. I heartily agree. My question is, how exactly do they do that? It seems to me that everything in our society, especially regarding the educational system and all the rest, is designed to facilitate a career. Well, that's a great question, Charlie, and I have to cut his question short in order to answer it to say, look, I think that there is no profession, no calling, no vocation that is more demanding than being a wife and a mother. And I think that in so many cases, what we need are educated wives and mothers. And so I would encourage a young woman to go to college, yes, in order that she can be a good teacher of her children. Whether she ever works in the marketplace one day, she needs to receive all the education that she can properly receive in order to be ready to fulfill all that God would call her to be as a mom. Finally, a question about cussing. And someone writes in to ask about cussing, saying, you know, are these words really bad words? They're not in the Bible as such. I really do not know how to argue about this. What would you suggest? Well, profanity and bad words are often culture dependent. In other words, they're in a certain context. But there are vulgarisms and profanities and obscenities that Christians should never speak. And, you know, when it comes down to this, it's not because the sound is somehow objectively immoral. It's because the context denotes something that is immoral. Reminds me of an email I got along these lines, and someone said, what are the wrong curse words? Please answer quickly. My ability to sit down might rest on this. Sometimes the questions really are important, aren't they? We'll be back tomorrow for Intelligent Christian Conversation. I'm Albert Mohler.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmohler.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmohler.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.